F2. Number 23B.
But in order to do that, really, that we must hold fast from the beginning of our confidence, and be steadfast unto the end. He there says, you know, Jesus called you brethren. He didn't say that you are something very different from me, from Jesus. He called you brethren and made you partakers of his way of salvation. Therefore, always the call there, harden not your heart, as our fathers did in the wilderness, who perished there on account of an evil heart of unbelief. Can you see how he now shows that we too should accept that way of salvation and not harden your heart by unbelief? Then he goes to the next one, to D, where he shows that obedience in faith leads to the day of rest. See, the whole way of salvation is always that great question which the Jews had, that they said, the Bible promised us a day of rest, but we have never attained the day of rest. Is therefore that promise true or not? They doubted that the Bible would give the answer. They said, what's wrong about us that we can't get into the day of rest? God promised that day of rest, that he would lead us into the day of rest. So you see what Hebrews says. I go again through the ABCD. He says, yes, in the Bible, God has, without doubt, with signs and wonders, shown that there is a way. But Jesus alone really submitted himself to that way and accepted that revelation 100%. And therefore, he could go into the day of rest. Then, D, he said, but he said to us, you are my brethren. You have the same right and the same possibilities to do what I do. You are not a bit different than I am. So you too can go the way if you don't harden again as your fathers your heart and die in the wilderness. If you really accept that way and subject yourself to that way, then you can do it too. What? Now we come to see. What is the method? What is the means to do it? He said, through faith and not through obedience to the law, not through the works of the law. So he asked there that we should use this faith. You see, that faith which really was the whole subject of the epistles. He said, you know very well, he says in Hebrews, you know very well that right at the beginning of the Bible, God said that God rested on the seventh day and that there is a day of rest. The promise is there. But all through the Bible, again and again, he said, somebody came up and said, there will be a day of rest. Then another one says, there will be a day of rest, but there never was a day of rest. See, they never got into the day of rest. So why, he says, didn't they get into the day of rest? He said, because they had no faith in Christ. They always tried, you see, they had not the right scientific method, namely to enter into that day of rest through faith. They always tried to enter it through the works of the law, through their own merit. He says here, God did rest on the seventh day from all his works, but the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. See, he said, the promise was always there, but it didn't profit anything, it didn't do anything to them. Nobody could make a profit of it, could not profit of it. Why, he says, because it was not mixed with faith. lacking faith, you see, the men of the Old Testament just never found that rest. Therefore, a Sabbath rest still awaits the people of God. See, he says, therefore, for the Jews, a Sabbath day still awaits them, still awaiting. They haven't gone into it. They haven't reached it yet. Let us then make every effort to enter into that rest, he says, through faith. So that's the first subject, the word, you see. Did I make myself clear how he builds it up? Very simply, you see. Just review, so to say, the Bible, the Old and New Testament, just review it and say, well, the Bible wants to give us a method how to get out of the Adam dream and to get into that day of rest, to the day of perfection. That's the Bible. Well, he says, first, says, the Bible has revealed that way. There's no mistake about it. He says, there's no mistake about it. You can't say you don't know it. The whole history, Bible, biblical history is full of it. And God came and showed it with signs and wonders. You can't say I don't know it. Then, he says, Jesus took that earnestly. He submitted himself to that way and therefore could reach the day of rest. So it's practicable. More or less he wants to say that what God had revealed is very practical and provable. It can be done, so to say. And Jesus showed that it can be done. Then comes the third step always, where it concerns all of us, where Jesus said, you are my brethren, you can do it too. You can do it too if you don't harden your heart. If you too subject yourself to that method, then you can do it too. And then comes the fourth point, which says, but what was missing? What was missing? The scientific understanding was missing. Faith was missing. Therefore they had always only the promise. The promise is always in the future, you see. It's always in the future. And as they didn't have faith, which faith really brings the future and the present into one, because it's the oneness of God and man which is established. They could never enter the day of rest. So it says, therefore accept faith, and then you have the scientific method to do it. So that was the way. And you will see when you read it that the subject changes from one verse to the other. Not even at the break of a chapter, it's in the middle of the chapter where the subject breaks completely, and you just feel another scene, so to say, is now depicted. Quite a different one, the high priest. You may ask me, why did it break in the middle of a chapter? Why not at the end of a chapter? Perhaps you have notice that time and time again when you have studied some of our books and of Mr. Dawley's books, when he gave a layout of a biblical book, that perhaps the breaks of one subject to the other would be right in the middle of a chapter, not at the end of the chapter. Well, you know who made the chapters? The Bible was not written in chapters. The Bible was not written in verses. The Bible was written in one uninterrupted way, you see, without paragraphs, without full stops, not even full stop at the end of a sentence, without paragraph, without chapters. Well, who made those verses? Who put the Bible into verses and chapters? Well, that was very, very late. I can't tell you exactly the date, but it was in the middle of the 16th century, around about 1500 and something, when they began to print the Bible instead of writing the Bible. The printing business brought that with it. And so very late, some nice printer who was a bright guy thought it's much more readable, a Bible, when it's put into chapters and put into verses. And so from that moment on, human intelligence and human ways and means brought in chapters and verses. Is somebody here who perhaps knows more exactly about this or not? When it was around about that time. So you see, we mustn't be disturbed if we find a structure in a biblical book which does not at all in any way coincide with the breaking up of the biblical text in chapters and verses. That was just a practical mean of a good businessman and a good printer who did it. There is nothing divine about chapters and verses. So that man just must have read the Bible and thought, well, what is it talking about? Well, here I make a new chapter. But we can't expect that he was so spiritually minded that he could see the spiritual structure of the Bible. So we come to the second vertical column, the Christ, as the high priest. And he shows now in this second column the subject of the old high priest and the new high priest. When you read it through, you will see he constantly compares, so to say, the nature of the old high priest and the nature of the new high priest. The new high priest was the Christ. The old high priest was that high priest which was from the line of Aaron. He shows that the high priest is the Savior. But what was the old high priest? He says, well, the old high priest was taken from men. He was elected out of men. Whereas the new high priest, he says, is the Son of God. He is really selected by God. Elected by God. That the old high priest was called after the order of Aaron. Always the eldest son of Aaron, of the line of Aaron, became high priest. As we can understand what sort of high priest they had after a few generations. So it was all built on progeny, of material progeny, that high priest. Whereas the real high priest, he says, is called after the order of Melchizedek. After the order of Melchizedek. That Melchizedek, who was without father, without mother, is now without descent, without beginning, without end. That's the high priest, a spiritual high priest. He says that the old high priest is appointed after the law of a carnal commandment. And says, but now we have a new high priest, which is appointed after the power of an endless life. He mostly uses more or less the same terms in order to compare the two. He says that the old high priest is mortal. He dies, goes away, whereas the new high priest is forever with us after the order of Melchizedek. He's without end. He says the old high priest of the old dispensation needs to offer up daily sacrifices. Every day he has to offer sacrifices for his own sins. Whereas the new high priest, the Christ, Jesus, made one sacrifice when he offered up himself. There is just one sacrifice and he offered up himself. He said the old high priest had infirmities. He wasn't sinless, but because he was not sinless, he had to offer always an offering also for his sins, whereas the new high priest is perfect now and forever. So you see, if we accept the new high priest, we accept a new high priest which has all those qualities which he depicted as the new high priest, the high priest which is elected from God. Where we elect ourselves. You know, where we are just a David who didn't bother if he is allowed to take the showbread or not. He just went into that holy and said, I take it. I don't care If anybody allows me to take that holy thing, and if they say, you are not pure enough to have it, I don't care, I take it. See, that's what we have to do. We have just to take possession of that high priest. That high priest, which is the Son of God, which is eternal, which is incorporeal, which is complete, which is spiritual. That is the high priest we have to have. We don't need any other high priests all around. Everywhere we have high priests who tell us what to do and when to do and what we are allowed to do and if we are allowed to do it and if we are advanced far enough to do it and if we do it right and if we do it wrong. There is one Christ, our high priest, on this way. He has to tell us all things. But he is a very, very severe master, that high priest. He says you have to subject yourself completely to that Christ. So, how? Let's go through that column and just see how Hebrews again, in the same ordered way, builds up that subject of the high priest. First he shows that God has revealed the new high priest as the Son of God. You see, the first point is always that God revealed it, that God has revealed it. First he had revealed the way of salvation. Now here in the second vertical column you have that God has revealed that Son of that high priest as the Son of God, who has passed through the heavens. Who has passed through the heavens, a high priest able to sympathize with everyone's weaknesses. So after having shown that this high priest is not something which men have established, which men have sought out, that it is not a high priest which is after a corporeal or an organizational line and comes out of an organizational line, but that he is the Son of God, then he says, and Jesus went and claimed it. He said, all right, if God reveals that there is a Christ, then we come to the second step. Then Jesus shows how he claimed it. He claims the office of that Christ as high priest right for himself. See, we have here that what we have seen in 1 Thessalonians, that we have to make ourselves the Son of God. The Christ is a fact in being. That's revealed. Now we have to claim that fact. We have to claim that Christ for ourselves. And that's what Jesus did. He just said, all right, I have seen what the Christ is. The prophets have told me the nature of the Christ, but they have always put it into the future. So Jesus said, all right, then I go and claim it right now where I am. And he claimed it. He had to claim his high priesthood. He said, after the order of Melchizedek, you see, he said, all right, I am that Christ after the order of Melchizedek, where it says, thou art a priest forever after the order of Ezekiel. And he offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death. See how he claimed it. You see, it wasn't just that the divine sense of the Christ here, that Jesus was the Son of God. Here he showed how through much prayer, how through much struggle, how through much supplication, how through much tears and strong crying, you just can feel the tone, how he had to hold fast with all his might to the fact that he is the Christ. It wasn't just given to him and he had to struggle for him. See, he had to take hold of it, and through much prayer and through much supplication and through strong crying and tears, he had to claim for him that he is the Christ. That's what we have to do, you see. So he did it, and it said, though he, you see how here it's very, very clear. It's in one verse it said, though though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. See, again, that divinely we are the Son of God. But from the human point of view, we have to make ourselves the Son of God. Though he were a son, we can't just say, well, I'm the Son of God. That's so true, what I say. But we can't leave it at the level of divine science. We have to bring it down to the level, at least, of absolute Christian science and claim that fact for ourselves. And claim it. And learn obedience by the things which he suffered. It wasn't so easy for Jesus to be the Son of God. See, we always think, well, that was wonderful. In that baptism, God just came down and said, now thou art the Son of God. And then everything was happy and finished and peaceful, and he was in the day of rest. He wasn't at all in the day of rest. There it only began. Only then, when we realize a higher ideal, then to claim that higher ideal and be faithful to that higher ideal needs quite a bit. So he claimed it. But because he claimed it, he was able to fulfill it. And it made him perfect, as it was said. Then we go further in the column. After he has shown that Jesus did claim that high priest, now it comes to the third, to us. We all, you see, that we all must adhere to the new high priesthood and must never abandon it. Now it comes that we all have to claim it. And he says how we should do it, how we should claim that Christ's sonhood, and that we shouldn't crucify the Son of God afresh, but that we should anchor our consciousness right in the holies of holies. Then he goes further again to the last, to D, you see, to the signs of it, where we see through faith we have an eternal priesthood. He says that which really makes that priesthood eternal in us, see, is again faith. We must do that claiming and claiming and claiming, not through human will, not through mortal will, but through faith again, through the Christ faith. See, because only the Christ faith really gives us that power which enables us to win a victory. So he says that the old covenant has made nothing perfect. The old covenant, because it was devoid of faith. So he asked us that the new high priest really should be appointed not after the law of the carnal commandment, but through faith, after the power of an endless life. Can you hear always? You see, he just goes always to the four and to the four. He just sees that all there is about the reality is that we see the city four square. At the city four square in all its reflection, you see. Here it is the four times four. Later, when you read those which is put here in smaller types, you always see that he embellishes that always four times four times four. It's just like a mosaic, you know, with completely systematic arrangements, you see, where you just put one stone to the other and everything that comes out is one balanced pattern, so to say, of the four and the four and the four and the four. The four in divine science, the four in absolute Christian science, afterwards the four in Christian science. And within those four you have the reflection of the four and the reflection of the four. Just to say, all that there is going on in being is just the one infinite being expressing itself in its analysis as the Word of God, the Christ of God, the Christianity of God, and the science of God. And if we get into that rhythm, we have the way of salvation. All right. Now we come to the third vertical column, Christianity. the sanctuary. So it's very logical how it is that it's a way. He says there is a way. Well, then he says, who is going to lead you on that way? The Christ will lead you on that way. The Christ is that which guides us on the way. So he takes the high priest that leads us. Then he says, well, to where does that way lead to? It leads into a sanctuary. What is that sanctuary? And so in the third column we have that sanctuary, the Christianity Center. And there again, you see, he depicts the old sanctuary and compares it with the new sanctuary. He shows that the sanctuary of the Old Testament was never the real thing. Was always symbols and patterns of the real thing. That Moses saw the real thing on the Mount of Vision, but that he always brought it down into symbols. He had to bring it down into symbols. He had to put it down into symbols of the tabernacle and of the whole of the tabernacle and the how the priests should be elected and what the office of the priest is and how they should serve in that tabernacle and so on, what their garment should be and what their hat should be and what they should have on their breast, the breastplate, and so on, everything put into symbol. The real thing Moses may have seen, but he never gave it. So he shows that the old sanctuary wasn't the real thing. That was made. It was, he calls it, the old, that the new tabernacle is the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. That the tabernacle of the Old Testament is man-made, man-thought. Man had figured it out. Man had symbolized it. But he says that new sanctuary, into which Jesus went, was the real tabernacle, the spiritual realm. The priests minister in a sanctuary, in the Old Dispensation, in a sanctuary which is only a copy and shadow of the heavenly. That they didn't have the real thing. They didn't have the real thing. But that Moses had erected the tabernacle according to the pattern showed to him in the Mount. They were copies of heavenly things, as the New English Bible calls them. They were just copies, not the original. See? Now we have to see that we don't worship in the copy, symbols, patterns of the real thing. That we are very careful that we see the real thing is only idea. The reality is only God and his idea. And the moment we begin to worship on another plane, where we worship the symbols, where we worship people, where we worship matter, where we worship this and that, then we are not in the real sanctuary. That's the old sanctuary. They were copies of heavenly things. They were holy places made with hands. Holy places made with hands, and not the very image of the thing. He says that the new high priest is a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not men. But Christ is a high priest, he says, of good things to come, by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. Can you always hear how it says, God made, man made, God made, man made? And he says, don't use your Christ on that way of salvation to worship man-made things. Man-made, a man-made universe. Worship the divine universe, God-made universe. For Christ has entered not the sanctuary made by man's hands, which is only a symbol of the reality, but heaven itself. Here it's very clear in this verse. Yes. So here it is, you see, the sanctuary. You just pointed this out to get the feel that now the subject is Christianity, the realm in which we live and move and have our being. Now that realm in the Old Testament was just a symbol and a pattern, not the real thing. And he says now what has to be done is that that translation takes place into the new sanctuary, that which is made by God. And so he depicts it again through the four points. First, again he says, he shows that God has now revealed a new sanctuary, the spiritual realm. That's the first thing he says. He says, now, after all, you see, God said to Moses, well, you break it down. You break those commandments down to that level where the people can get hold of it. You just veil your face so they can't see what you have. Veil it. And so he put the veil also in the before the Holy of Holies.